Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RZVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Ben Walton. Thank you, Ben. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you to CPD Solutions for inviting me to give this webinar, and thank you to those joining me. So this is part one of two webinars on articular fractures in dogs and cats, and over the next hour we shall concentrate on the articular fractures affecting the thoracic limb. So our main aim of treatment, or our first goal when treating articular fractures, should be to achieve normal function. If we can't achieve normal function, the next best thing is to achieve pain-free function or near normal activity levels. And if we can't achieve that, the bare minimum we should be aiming for is a satisfactory quality of life. The principles of articular fracture treatment, as laid out by AO and various other textbooks, are primarily the first three in this bullet list here. So we are after accurate anatomic reduction, stable fixation, and if possible, immediate mobilization of the limb. And all of this should be achieved as far as possible through the most atraumatic approach that we can do. There are some challenges in the management of articular fractures, and this can begin even with the diagnosis of articular fractures. And sometimes it is quite difficult to understand the extent of fractures close to the joint, and this is confounded by overlying radiographic lines, such as the joint surface, etc. And often, for example, in the case of the acetabulum of the pelvis, overlying anatomy. And in some situations, three-dimensional imaging, such as CT scanning, might be beneficial. Arthrocentesis can give us some clues to the presence of intra-articular trauma, and what we would expect to see following an articular fracture would be either fresh blood if the fracture is rather acute, or hemosiderin-stained joint fluid, which will be kind of an orangey-tinted colour if the fracture is more chronic than that. Another difficulty when it comes to treating articular fractures can be the surgical access. For example, accessing the supraglenoid tubercle of the scapula can be quite challenging in order to approach that without damaging the periarticular structures. Implant positioning is a perennial problem. By definition, these joints include and are sitting very, very close to the joint. These fractures are sitting very close to the joint. So positioning implants such that they have sufficient hold on the bone but without entering the joint surface can be challenging. Similarly, and related to that, these fragments can be relatively small in relation to the forces that are acting upon them, and therefore getting implants in there which are sufficiently strong to resist the forces acting upon these fragments can be challenging. And all of this leads us to the issue of achieving early function. So when we are balancing up our implant positioning and our implant strength against the need, if we can, to avoid any form of post-operative external coaptation, we very often have quite a difficult surgical situation on our hands. So what are our options for treating articular fractures? So our first option is the obvious one, which is primary reduction and fixation. Sometimes the fragments are too small to fixate, even with the best intentions or the most skilled surgeon. And in those cases, sometimes removal of the intra-articular fragment may be necessitated. Conservative treatment is an option. We'll talk about some intra-articular fractures later on in this webinar where external coaptation actually may be a reasonable approach. And although it's counterintuitive, early mobilization of some intra-articular fractures may be relevant in certain situations. For example, in humeral condylar fractures in people, there is a subset of these fractures which are very highly comminuted, and these are referred to by some surgeons as a bag of bones scenario. And in those situations, one treatment option is to go straight for early mobilization of the unfixated fractures with the therapeutic goal of a functional non-union that allows some mobilization of the elbow. And in certain situations, this can be preferable to arthrodesis of the elbow, and it may be applied in situations where a total elbow arthroplasty may not be possible. Moving on from that, we have the salvage procedures, and these salvage procedures will have different relevance to different joints and different scenario. So the obvious salvage procedures, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, are excision arthroplasty, joint arthrodesis, and total joint replacement. So that brings us over the sort of introductory discussion onto some clinical examples of the type of articular fractures that we may see in the thoracic limb. So we're going to start out with the shoulder, and we're going to discuss three types of intra-articular fractures that we see in the shoulder. Now, all of these are fractures of the glenoid. We do see the occasional intra-articular fracture of the humeral head, most frequently in juvenile animals, but they're not a particularly common presentation at all. Not that any of these are the most common presentations, in fairness. So we'll start out with the supraglenoid tubercle fractures. Scapular fractures account for just over 1% of all fractures in dogs. So as a bone, it doesn't get fractured all that frequently, and that reflects the amount of soft tissue coverage and the protection that the scapula is afforded by being in such close apposition to the trunk. But supraglenoid fractures do account for approximately 70% of all scapular fractures. So as scapular fractures go, these supraglenoid ones are particularly relevant. It is essentially an avulsion fracture because it is the point of origin of the biceps tendon. So the biceps muscle originates as a thick, strong tendon on the supraglenoid tubercle and then courses distally through the intertubercular groove of the proximal humerus and then on down the brachium to insert on the radius and ulna. Also importantly in this regard is that the supraglenoid tubercle is a separate center of ossification in the growing animal. So a common presentation for supraglenoid fractures are young, large breed dogs that have been exposed to exuberant activity. And like a lot of sort of muscle or tendon strains, it's believed that these injuries are often the result of eccentric loading. That is, the muscle is resisting movement in the opposite direction, generates a huge tensile force, and the physis behind the supraglenoid tubercle is not able to withstand that force. The important considerations for avulsions of the supraglenoid tubercle are that this is a relatively large intra-articular fragment, but also mechanically it is the origin of the biceps tendon, which gives us a bit of a job to do mechanically when we are thinking about fixating this fragment. The treatment options are lag screw fixation, and I've put this in bold there, as I would say that for all supraglenoid fractures which are large enough and in which the presentation is reasonably acute within a week or two, then lag screw fixation is probably the fixation of choice. For smaller dogs or smaller fragments, it may be difficult to achieve a lag screw fixation without running the risk of further injuring or further fissuring of the supraglenoid tubercle. And this is a consideration that we see in a number of these intra-articular fractures and comes back to one of those introductory slides. We are having to achieve relatively robust fixation in relatively small, and in the case of supraglenoid tubercles, often quite soft bone fragments. So if it's too small to get a lag screw in, a pin and tension band wire is feasible. Conservative management of quite small fragments may be considered, and this is particularly relevant if the presentation is quite chronic. So sometimes the presentation with these dogs is that they have had an acute onset of severe lameness sometime before presentation, which has then settled down, and then the dog is left with a more chronic, sort of milder to moderate lameness. And in those cases, primary reduction and fixation could be challenging. As the supraglenoid tubercle is kind of pulled away from the articulating surface between the humeral head and the glenoid, it is possible in some cases to manage these conservatively and rely on fibrous stabilization of that tubercle. And in cases where fixation is not possible, yet we think that the fragment is causing clinical issues, we can consider resection of that fragment. Once you've resected that fragment, then you have a decision to make about whether you perform tenodesis of the biceps, which is usually done with a leg screw and a washer, or sometimes with a staple, whereby you fix the biceps of origin to the cranial aspect of the humerus. So this example is a case report from Agnes Danouche in JSAP in 2002. And this was a minimally invasive approach that they took, attempting to lag screw fixate a supraglenoid fracture in a young large breed dog under arthroscopic guidance. What we can see from the immediate post-operative radiographs is that the reduction is imperfect, and the implants are seated relatively far out from the bone surface, which will reflect the soft tissue attachment, particularly that thick, firm, tenderness material of the proximal biceps. Nevertheless, despite the imperfect reduction and implant placement, Danouche did report a good outcome for this dog. Moving on from the supraglenoid fractures then, we're going to turn our attention towards the more caudal aspect of the glenoid and look at these caudal glenoid fragments. And these are something which you may see with a relative degree of frequency, and it is good to know how to interpret these fragments and how to manage them. Now, whether or not they should be considered an intraarticular fracture or not is a moot point. The early reports of this condition, including this paper by Olivieri from VCOT, approximately 2004, where they looked at a series of these cases, it's not entirely clear that these are fragments or whether, as the title suggests, they are an accessory ossification center of the caudal glenoid. One challenge with interpreting the findings of seeing these caudal glenoid fragments is that they are often identified as an incidental finding. So a number of dogs will have these caudal glenoid fragments, yet they are not contributing to any clinical lameness in that dog. So we need to start thinking about how we can interpret these findings better and decide whether or not these are clinically relevant. So these are stills from a CT report from a case that Mark Straw saw over at Beechwood Veterinary Hospital in Doncaster recently. And these are very nice images. And what we have on the left here is the plain CT scan, sagittal plane, of the humerus and the glenoid. And we can see just here the caudal fragment. But it's difficult to know whether that caudal fragment is causing an issue or not. But when we look over at the image on the right, what we have here is a CT arthrogram. And that radio-opaque semilunar shape that we can see in the middle is the contrast agent. Now, just below the radio-opaque crescent, you can see a thin dark line, thin radiolucent crescent. And that is the articular cartilage interposed between the contrast agent and the subchondral bone. And what we can see is around about the middle of the humeral head here on the caudal aspect is that that articular cartilage line disappears and we have abutment of the contrast agent right up to the subchondral bone. And what that suggests is erosion of the articular cartilage directly opposite the caudal glenoid fragment. And in a situation like that, providing there are no other obvious causes of lameness, I think it is fair to assume clinical relevance of that caudal fragment. The treatment is removal, and it is relatively straightforward, done under arthroscopic guidance, a bit more challenging under an open arthrotomy. And then we'll move on to other glenoid fractures. This case is a cat that presented to me approximately 2 years ago after falling fair height out of a window. And what we can see here on the far left image is this medial fragment off the medial rim of the glenoid. The fracture is not particularly visible on the medial lateral view preoperatively. Now, this fragment is also an avulsion fracture, and this is an avulsion of the origin of the medioglenohumeral ligament. So we've repaired this by stabilizing the fragment with two screws, which are in fact suture anchor screws, and placing a further suture anchor in the proximal humerus. So the normal glenohumeral ligament, medial glenohumeral ligament, is a sort of V-shaped. And what we've done is between these suture anchors, as well as repairing the fracture, we have almost augmented the damaged medial glenohumeral ligament with proline sutures. And that cat went on to make a full recovery. Other treatment options to consider for glenoid fractures include partial scapulectomy. So this was a case report from Ria Plesman from a few years ago. And what they encountered was this longitudinal fissure in the caudal part of the scapula, extending to include the caudal aspect of the glenoid. We can just see the fissure as well running up in the sagittal plane. So this was a comminuted fracture whereby there was not enough bone stock to satisfactorily stabilize the fragments back together. So what these authors did, if we see on the left here, is resection of the whole fragment. And we can see that what we're left with on the left is a relatively small glenoid. Some years later, or at least some months later, they re-radiographed this cat. And what we can see is that there is regrowth, if you like, or remineralization of tissue in this area, sort of extending the glenoid. And these authors reported a very good functional recovery for this cat. And the other salvage option available to us in severe cases of articular fractures of the shoulder is arthrodesis. This is a severely comminuted scapular fracture that my colleague Professor Innes had to deal with a few weeks ago. He made the approach with a view to attempting stabilization of this fracture, but once he was in there and he realized the amount of fissuring of the supraglenoid tubercle, it became very clear that it wasn't going to be possible to robustly stabilize that fragment back to the scapula. Given that we were going to be left with a very small rim of glenoid left, it would be likely that the stability of the shoulder would be severely compromised and function would likely be poor. With that in mind, we can see some of the comminution. Sorry, just going back a step. We can see the comminution on the preoperative radiographs here. But with these considerations in mind, what Professor Innes decided to do was perform an arthrodesis. And what we have here is debridement of the cartilage of the humeral head and the caudal part of the glenoid. A 4.5mm cortex screw applied in lag fashion to create compression at that level. The shoulder is fixed in a near anatomic angle, and the repair has been further stabilized with this locking plate. The outcome on that dog cannot yet be recorded. It cannot yet be reported. It's only about 2 or 3 weeks post-operative. But so far, so good. And what we have here is a video of a somewhat smaller dog that had received bilateral shoulder arthrodesis, not because of fractures, but because of congenital medial shoulder luxation. But what we can see is that even with bilateral arthrodesis, the function is pretty acceptable. This dog led a very active life with sort of normal activity levels as far as the owner was concerned. So shoulder arthrodesis can carry with it a fair to good prognosis. That's us for the shoulder, for the time being at least. And we're going to move on now to the more common articular fractures of the elbow. Now, I think it's fair to say that the articular fractures of the elbow are by far the most common articular fractures that we see, certainly in the thoracic limb, probably overall. And we will go through primarily spend a fair bit of time now discussing considerations around the management of humeral condylar fractures. We will discuss also coronoid process fractures as a separate clinical entity to fragmented coronoid process or medial coronoid process disease. And I'll also show you some examples of some interesting Anconeus fractures that have been reported and that you may see from time to time. So what we have here on the right is an image from the BSAVA manual of small animal fracture repair, which demonstrates or illustrates, I should say, the classification of humeral condylar fractures. And I'm sure that most of you will be familiar with these images. Lateral condylar fractures, whereby you have this intracondylar fissure and a epicondylar fracture through the lateral side, account for between 50 and 60% of all condylar fractures, depending upon which case series you read. Medial condylar fractures are the least common, whereby just the medial side fractures, and that's because this medial epicondylar ridge is much thicker, much more substantial than the lateral side. And medial condylar fractures account for only 2 to 11% of all condylar fractures. Dicondylar fractures occur with a frequency which is in between those two and account for between 33 and 45% of all condylar fractures. And these are sometimes described as Y fractures or T fractures or combination fractures, depending on the configuration and the direction of the epicondylar components. We see condylar fractures in two distinct populations of dogs. The first is puppies, and we see it quite frequently in small breed puppies, for example, Jack Russell Terriers. With increasing frequency, I would say myself and personal communication with other orthopedic specialists is there is an increasing frequency of French bulldogs being presented with these kind of fractures. And then the second population that we see it in is adult dogs. Now, these are primarily Springer Spaniels in this country. Other Spaniel breeds are included. And occasionally, but with less frequency, we see it in other breeds like Labradors, German Shepherds, Pointers and Rottweilers, amongst others. We'll discuss the principles of repair. So we'll go through these in more detail over the following slides, but the kind of decision making that we're going to have to make when we are managing one of these fractures surgically is what implants we're going to place and where. So the main part of all of these repairs is the transcondylar implant, and one consideration for these is whether these are placed in lagged fashion, so that you achieve compression across the intracondylar fissure, or whether they are placed in positional fashion, whereby you have bone implant grip either side of the fissure. And we'll talk through the different implants and how these may be placed shortly. Once your transcondylar implant is in position, the next thing to consider is what kind of anti-rotational device are you going to use, or what kind of device are you going to use on the epicondylar component of the fractures. And I call these anti-rotational devices, but note in brackets there, it's only an anti-rotational device if the bone is reconstructed and is therefore load sharing. If you have supracondylar comminution, these devices are doing more than just being anti-rotational, and they're actually acting as a bridging or a buttress implant. So the options here are a pin, such as a Kirchner wire or arthrodesis wire, just a screw or screws, or a plate and screws. The other consideration before we get to what implants we're going to put in there is how we're going to place them. And broadly speaking, there are two options when you're dealing with, for example, a lateral condylar fracture. But this is true for any unicondylar fracture for sure. Your options for placing these implants include an inside-out approach or an outside-in approach. And we'll talk you through both of those over the next few slides. So, and with an inside-out approach, what we do is we reflect the fractured part of the condyle distally, hinged on the collateral ligament, and we drill a hole from the fracture surface to the outside of the bone, to the epicondyle. Then we reduce the fracture, clamp it in place with reduction forceps, put our drill bit back in that hole, either through a sleeve if we're placing it in lag fashion, or directly through the hole if we're placing our implant in positional fashion, and we drive the drill bit across the opposite condyle or the opposite side of the condyle. Now, one pitfall to note with this approach is that there is a natural tendency to drill your hole perpendicular to the fracture surface. Now, if you do that and it is a lateral condylar fracture, what you find is that this drill hole will exit relatively distally. And this means that when you reduce your fracture and complete your drill hole across the condyle, that the drill hole that you have made and therefore the implant that's going to follow that hole will be positioned at an angle to the transcondylar axis, or at an angle to the joint surface. And as you'll see later when I discuss outcomes and complications from these fracture repairs, that can be a bit of an issue. So it is important when you are approaching your fractures in this way that you drill that first line, that first hole, at an angle to the fracture surface, such that you're aiming for that hole to exit in a more proximal position, so that when the fragment is reduced and you complete that hole, it is parallel to the transcondylar axis and to the joint surface. Your other option is to place a transcondylar implant from the outside in. And with this approach, the fragment is reduced and held in reduction, and a drill hole is drilled either all the way across the condyle in one go if you're placing a positional implant, or you might overdrill the cis fragment with a wider drill bit and then drill through that and a sleeve into the trans part of the condyle so that you can achieve a lagged fixation. But when we do this, we need to be mindful of our anatomic landmarks for drilling this hole. And the next few slides will just consider some tips and tricks and things to consider when you are placing these implants in an outside-in fashion. So this paper was published by Duncan Barnes in VetSurg a few years ago, and this is really defining a safe corridor for transcondylar implantation for humeral intracondylar fissures or IOHC, but it is equally relevant in this discussion of condylar fractures if we are thinking about placing our screws from an outside-in approach. So the first thing that he did was define the lateral epicondyle and the medial epicondyle. And this was a CT study of a number of dogs, defining the optimal entry and exit points for transcondylar implants and what kind of angles and margins for error you had when placing these implants. So taking as a starting point, he took the extremity of the lateral epicondyle and the proximal part of the extremity of the medial epicondyle. He then defined on cross-sectional images the optimal exit and entry points for a transcondylar implant, and then measured the position of that relative to these points in a distal and cranial fashion. So the optimal entry or exit point for the lateral entry, so if we look at the graph on the left here, the two box plots, box and whisker plots on the right, entry from the lateral epicondyle, is 0.3 of the isthmus diameter. So if you measure the diameter of the isthmus to normalize your measurements and multiply that 0.3, if you place your implant 0.3 of an isthmus diameter distal and 0.3 of an isthmus diameter cranial on the lateral aspect, you'll be in a good spot. On the medial aspect, it is also 0.3 of a humeral isthmus diameter cranial, but only 0.2 distal. So relative to this point, it's slightly more proximal on the medial side. And that's good to know, particularly if you are placing it from medial to lateral for the first time. And in the context of condylar fractures, that's going to be if you are managing a medial medial condylar fracture. The next thing that Duncan reported was the safe corridors in terms of angulation, whether you're placing these medially or laterally. And if we concentrate on the images on the right here, these are frontal plane sections through the humeral condyle. So proximal is at the top of the screen and distal is at the lower part of the screen. And if we look at this image D, this is the safe corridors when you're drilling from the lateral side over to the medial side. And above that is the safe corridor if you're drilling from the medial side over to the lateral side. And what we can see is that you have a wider safe corridor coming from lateral to medial. And the reason for that is this radial fossa here, which is on the proximal part of the capitellum, or the lateral part of the condyle, which dips down and sort of narrows the lateral part of the condyle in a proximal distal direction. So there are potentially some benefits to placing implants from medial to lateral, especially obviously if you are managing a medial condylar fracture, but there are some pitfalls as well, and it's worth being cognizant of those. Another option, and again, the examples in these images are a humeral intracondylar fissure, not a displaced fracture. But another option for ensuring safe positioning of a transcondylar implant is to use intraoperative fluoroscopy. Unfortunately, intraoperative fluoroscopy is not particularly widely available, particularly in general practice. And even where it is available, it's not as simple as you might think using fluoroscopy to position these implants, and therefore, you know, it's good and it's safe, but it does take some getting used to and can be relatively time consuming, especially during the learning phase. This is a technique which I commonly use, and this is my preferred technique for placing transcondylar implants in cases of humeral intracondylar fissure or IOHC, but again is relevant to condylar fractures when you're placing them from an outside-in approach. And this is using a Xyrex, although I'm sure other imaging tools and imaging software it would be feasible in. And what I do is I delineate my optimal axis, so I decide where I want my implant to be passing in these planar reconstructions. And then Xyrex has a tool where you can place, if you look over on this image, it's kind of a little bit messy here, but you can just about make out a little spot there with a green ring around it and another little spot there with the green ring around it. So these spots are placed right on the surface of the bone, right where this optimal axis has been defined. If you then reconstruct that for a three-dimensional images using the surface reconstruction pattern, these spots show up. And what you can do then is take these images. So this is the lateral side of the humerus. This is the medial side of the humerus in this dog. And then you can take these images to theatre with you, make a bilateral approach to the humerus, mark these points either with a spinal burr or a drill bit, something to give you a bit of purchase, and then use a C-guide or an aiming device. And that way, you have a pretty reliable way of making sure that you're going to be placing your transcondylar implant just where you want it. So that brings us on to this further consideration of what implants we're going to use. So for our transcondylar implant, like we've said, our options are going to be to place a positional type screw, a lag type screw. We might use a shaft screw. If you're not familiar what that is, I'll show you shortly. The humeral intracondylar repair system, which is a screw and system that is designed specifically for the treatment of intracondylar fissures and associated condylar fractures in Springer Spaniels. And in certain cases, you might consider the use of a smooth pin and not a screw at all. And then these are the epicondylar considerations, a pin, a screw, or a plate. And once you've decided you're going to use a plate, are you going to use a locking plate or a non-locking plate? So first of all, the transcondylar implant. If we are using the same implant in different fashions, which of course we can do with a cortex screw, these are the relative advantages of placing, for example, a cortex screw in positional fashion or in lag fashion. So for a positional screw, you have a greater bone implant interface. The thread of the screw engages bone on both sides of the fissure. And the benefit of this is that this reduces the risk of loosening. We know that the risk of loosening of orthopedic implants is decreased with increasing bone implant interface. The other benefit, which is more relevant or can be very relevant in young dogs, is that where the bone is softer, is that a positional screw is less likely to sink into the cis cortex, and therefore there is less risk of it wedging and creating an iatrogenic fracture in that fragment nearest to you. A positional screw can be used to stabilize the fragments with the fragments in compression by compressing the fragments first with pointed reduction forceps, for example, and placing the positional screw while the fragments are compressed. A leg screw does allow anatomic reconstruction and firm compression. The amount of compression that you'll achieve with a properly placed leg screw in bone of sufficient quality will far exceed the amount of compression that you'll achieve with point reduction forceps, for example. So there is an advantage to this direct implant-associated compression. And what that kind of compression gives you is load sharing. So by compressing the fracture sides together, you're generating a lot of friction, and that friction will share the load with the implant. In Hattersley's multi-center retrospective review of the management of humeral intracondylar fissures, published in VetSurg about 6 years ago, there was statistically a reduced risk of surgical site infection when these implants were placed in lag fashion compared to positional fashion. Now, that's not been particularly well explained, but it certainly was there as a statistical finding in that paper. So I think positional screws are particularly suited for puppies, and I would also consider the use of a washer or possibly countersinking the cis cortex to reduce that risk of that small fragment fracturing around your screw head. Leg screws are more applicable to adult dogs, and you know, these aren't hard and fast guidelines. There are arguments for using leg screws in puppies and adults, and similarly for using positional screws in both categories of dogs as well. But this is the broad outline that I would sort of consider when I'm treating these cases. So what we have here is a young dog, a juvenile Labrador Springer Spaniel cross with this incomplete fissure extending through the medial part of the humeral condyle up into the slightly deformed medial epicondylar ridge. And we've stabilized that with a cortex screw in positional fashion with a washer seated under the head of the screw to minimize the risk of further fissuring. Sometimes, though, it is not possible in very small young dogs to place a screw, even of the smallest size. And what we have here is a case treated by my colleague Mark Morton a few months ago, which was a very small, I think it was less than 1 kilogram, Yorkshire Terrier. And what we have here is an isthmus diameter, which is around about 3 or 4 millimeters. So very, very small indeed. I apologize for the image on the left being upside down and imperfect. But what we can see here is that Mark has used a transcondylar implant of a smooth arthrodesis wire and then two epicondylar implants of the same size, of the same fashion. And these were sort of the largest implants that Mark felt he could safely engage this bone with. And this fracture went on to heal without complication and without further displacement. The dog did clinically very well. this is your sort of standard of care transcondylar implant, if you like, for your Springer Spaniel-sized dog with a condylar fracture. And it is the 4.5 millimeter cortex screw. You can see that in this case, it has been used in combination with two lag screws. There's been a fairly long oblique portion to this fracture, which has enabled two lag screws to compress the fracture in the epicondylar region as well. It looks to me as though this screw has been placed in an inside-out fashion, perpendicular to the fracture line, because we can see that this is a good example of a case where the transcondylar implant deviates from the transcondylar axis. These 4.5 millimeter screws are essentially the standard of care, and that goes back to a paper in the late 90s by Butterworth and Innes, where they identified these incomplete fractures in Springer Spaniels and identified that when a 3.5 millimeter screw was placed, there was a very high risk of failure, and when a 4.5 millimeter screw was placed, there was a lower risk of failure. But these fissures, and I'm not going to dwell too long on the proposed pathogenesis of these fissures, but they appear possibly to be some kind of stress fracture. The fracture surfaces are often sclerotic and are not a are a biologically challenged area. So these fissures may never heal or have delayed healing, which places these implants under a high risk for fatigue failure. And fatigue failure of transcondylar screws for IOHC was reported by Charles et al. In veterinary surgery a few years ago. And you know, the failure mode was consistent with fatigue failure of these screws, and they were observed anything from 11 months to 3 years after surgery. The resistance to fatigue failure is directly related to the strength of the implant, and the strength of the implant is directly related to its cross-sectional area or its area moment of inertia. The shaft screw is a partially threaded screw, and what you can see in the image here from Andy Moore's paper is a 4.5 millimeter shaft screw applied to a case of humeral intracondylar fissure. Now, the core of a threaded section of a 4.5 millimeter cortex screw has a diameter of 3.1 mm. When you increase that cross-sectional area to 4.5 millimeters, as you do with a shaft screw, so the key thing about a shaft screw is that the diameter of the smooth section is equal to the outer diameter of the threaded section, you get a massive increase in screw strength and therefore markedly reduce your risk of screw failure. And Andy Moore's reported on the use of these shaft screws for the treatment of humeral condylar fractures and humeral intracondylar fissures a few years ago. There was, as you might expect, none of these implants fractured. He did report another complication, which was a screw back out. And these are potentially a very good screw for the management of these fractures due to their superior strength. But one concern with them is potentially this increased risk of screw back out. The threaded section is relatively short on these implants. It's just 10 millimeters long, regardless of the length of the screw, which gives you only a very limited amount of bone implant interface. And as you can see in this case of a lateral condylar fracture that was presented here, that screw was loosened and backed out somewhat. And that's a function of the reduced bone implant interface. That fracture that you saw in the last slide was revised with this implant, which is the humeral intracondylar repair system. This is a implant designed specifically for the treatment of humeral intracondylar fissures in spaniels and condylar fractures associated with those. And I'll just go through some of the features of that implant now. So the implant has a core diameter of 3 mil, so it's just slightly smaller than the core diameter of a threaded section of a 4.5 mil screw. But the central section is smooth, which may help protect it from fatigue failure. And it also allows over-drilling, so a custom drill bit comes with this implant that allows over-drilling around this shaft, and that void can then be packed with a bone graft substitute to encourage healing. It's a headless implant, so the head of the screw sits flush with the bone surface to reduce soft tissue irritation. And it is a variable pitch implant, so you have a cancellous type thread on the trans thread, which gives you good bone purchase, and a cis type thread on the cis thread. And what that means, that variable pitch gives you compression at the fracture site. So this is a relatively new implant, and I declare an interest in this as co-inventor of that implant, relatively early stages, but we expect to publish our first clinical series in the next couple of months. So we'll move on from that. This is a intraoperative photograph of of the humeral intracondylar repair system being used to stabilize a lateral condylar fracture. We can see we've got a couple of point reduction forceps, a large and a small here, compressing the condylar, the epicondylar region. The screw is partially placed, and we have demineralized bone matrix putty and a 14-gauge catheter injecting that putty into the void as the screw is inserted. So let's have a little look at outcomes and complications of humeral condylar fracture repairs. So this paper from Karen Perry et al. A few years ago was a multicenter retrospective study of 135 cases of lateral humeral condylar fracture. Key finding from this paper is that when a condylar screw or a screw and plate was used in the epicondyle, so they were all treated with a transcondylar implant. Some were treated with a epicondylar screw or a screw and plate, and some were treated with an epicondylar wire. And the key finding, to repeat myself, is that when an epicondylar wire was used, the complication rate was approaching 30%. When either a screw or screw and plate was used, the complication rate was a lot lower, down at near 10%. And that's important because dogs with complications were more likely to have a poor outcome in the long term. What we have here are images from a number of juvenile dogs that have been treated for condylar fracture. The central one here is a medial condylar fracture that has been treated with cortical screw in positional fashion with a washer and a supracondylar or epicondylar lag screw. Over on the right here, we actually have a dicondylar fracture in a young French bulldog that the medial side has been stabilized with a plate. A transcondylar screw has been placed. We can see the washer on the screw here. We can also see that it's been placed in an inside-out fashion and that screw line has deviated from the transcondylar axis. And the other thing of note here is that if you look at this image and the small lateral image in the corner, is you see just how caudally these plates can be placed or should be placed on that lateral epicondyle to avoid impingement of these screw tips into the articulating surface. And what we have over here on the left is a radiograph 2 or 3 weeks after a lateral condylar fracture was repaired with a transcondylar screw and an epicondylar wire. And I think that there is a trend towards plate fixation or screw fixation of the epicondylar part of these fractures, even in puppies, which reflects the findings of Perry and cases like that. This was a paper from Wanda Gordon, now Wanda Gordon Evans, from 2003, which looked at the frequency of post-traumatic osteoarthritis after humeral condylar fracture repair. All dogs got post-traumatic OA. The fracture reduction accuracy did not correlate particularly well, but came close to significance with OA or limb function. But ultimately, most of these dogs had a good or reasonable function. And I would say that the clinical prognosis for condylar fractures is generally good to excellent. This was a paper from a few years later which looked at the complication rate and risk factors associated with these surgical repairs. And again, Morgan reported approximately a 30% complication rate. But one of the key risks here was that the angle of the transcondylar screw from perpendicular to the fracture surface increased the risk of there being a fracture gap on the postoperative radiographs. And the presence of a fracture gap reduce the risk of failure to 25% from 0% when no gap was present. That's us on humeral condylar fractures. I'd like to thank Andrew Robinson from Divcote Referrals for these radiographs, which are from a... let's just explain what we're seeing here. What we can see here is fractures in both olecranons of this dog. The right side is more displaced, and this dog was presented with a right forelimb lameness. And we can see this minimally displaced fracture here. And a similar fracture was reported by Hattersley et al. In another Labrador. and they have CT and of the fracture preoperatively, and they treated this fracture with a lag screw and anti-rotational wire and reported a good outcome in that case. Interestingly, Andrew treated his case conservatively, and this dog returned to work. And there have been other reports, not published, but personal communication reports, etc., of similar kinds of fractures. And the typical presentation with these is often a prodromal lameness. These are often very active dogs, frequently working dogs. These fractures or lameness can be acute in onset, or deterioration in lameness can be acute in onset following a relatively minor trauma, for example, jumping out of a crate or jumping out of a car. So again, this appears to be some manifestation potentially of a stress fracture or fatigue fracture in this region. Just something to keep your eye out for is an interesting variation on intra-articular fractures of the elbow. Talk briefly about traumatic fracture of the medial coronoid process in dogs. So occasionally we will see a dog with acute onset lameness with pain localized to the elbow, and we will diagnose fragmentation of the medial coronoid process. Now the difference between these dogs and dogs with medial coronoid disease is that there often is no accompanying osteoarthritis. The dogs have no prior history of lameness, and lameness has been acute in onset. There is also a difference in terms of treatment outcome, because fragment removal or coronoid debridement carries with it a guarded to possibly fair prognosis in cases of coronoid disease, probably more towards the guarded side. Whereas arthroscopic removal of the fragments in these acute cases of traumatic fracture of the medial coronoid process is generally associated with a very rapid and very good improvement and return to near normal function. So again, something to be aware of and watch out for. That gives us around about 10 minutes to talk about intra-articular fractures of the carpus. And we're going to concentrate mostly on fractures of the radial carpal bone. Now, these fractures, in fairness, are probably stretching the title of this webinar. They're not particularly common, but as far as articular fractures of the carpus go, they probably are the most common single or unique presentation that you might see. So what we have here is a relatively old radiograph of a dog's carpus, courtesy of Professor Innes. And when we look closely, we can see that what we have down the center of the radial carpal bone here is this sagittal plane fracture, minimally displaced. Now, these fractures have been identified and reported and written up in at least three small case series. One of those case series was in the mid-90s in Jaha by Tomlin. And it's quite difficult to access Jaha. There's no online access at this stage to those older Jaha papers. So we'll concentrate on these two papers, which are available through online libraries, which is Lee's paper reviewing treatment of 15 dogs with radial carpal bone fracture from JSAP in 2004, and Nudi's from VCOT, in 2000, and Nudi's from 2004, a few years later. So let's take a little look at their results tables here, because a lot of the information that we're interested in is right here. So on the left, we have the results table of the cases seen by Lee. And when we look down this list, what we can see is that there is an overrepresentation of boxer dogs, a Rottweiler, a Springer Spaniel. Interestingly, this Springer Spaniel also had a condylar fracture in another limb. A greyhound there. And when we look over to Nudi's population, which was a European population compared to the UK population that Lee reported, we can see there is an overrepresentation of pointer and setter breeds. So pointers, setters, boxers, and Springer Spaniels are dogs that we may see these radial carpal bone fractures in. If we have a little look at the age, they're all sort of young to middle age, and again, the signalment for these dogs is usually very active dogs or working dogs. The males were overrepresented. And another telling thing on these tables is the duration of clinical signs that we can see here. So bar the occasional more acute case, These are mostly presented with chronic lameness, anything up to a year or more, signs of lameness. So that's the signalment and the presentation to look out for. Now, the pattern of the fragmentation of these fractures, and when it was recognized that a number of dogs were presenting with similar kind of fractures, then a theory was put forward as to why they might develop these. And similar to humeral intracondylar fissures, a prevailing theory was that this is incomplete ossification of the bone. And if we look at the embryology of the radial carpal bone, we can see that it starts out as three separate centers of ossification. And in different species, these will go on to develop different bones. So, for example, the human wrist will contain the scaphoid and the central carpal bone. And these are the sort of the names of the three centers. And the position of these three centers of ossification and the lines in between them correspond very closely to the fracture lines that we see in fractures of the radial carpal bone. Noody took some samples when he removed some of the smaller fragments and reviewed these histologically, and there was a persistence of cartilaginous areas, which again lends some credence to the theory that these may be cases of incomplete ossification. I promised you earlier that we would mention situations where external coaptation might actually be a reasonable treatment option for articular fractures, and this is where that comes in. What Lee reported was that there was a satisfactory clinical outcome in some cases following several months of external coaptation. All of Noody's cases were treated conservatively. They didn't treat any of theirs surgically. There was progression of OA in most cases, and there was some displacement of the fragments in others. Another option is primary fixation, but Lee's results weren't particularly encouraging, with three of the five fractures that were surgically stabilized progressing to require pancarpal arthrodesis. There have been other reports with better outcomes, but certainly a very challenging surgery and one that should be not undertaken lightly. There were fewer complications in the cases treated with pancarpal arthrodesis in Lee's series than there were in those treated with primary surgical fixation. And there is an argument, particularly where the cases are chronic and there is concomitant osteoarthritis, to skip straight to pancarpal arthrodesis in these cases. That said, Karen Perry, when she was an intern at Fitzpatrick's, reported a small series of cases, five cases, I believe, of radial carpal bone fractures that were treated using a self-compressing cannulated screw called the AccuTrack. Now, we got some close-up views here. So we can see the fissure just below the cartilage surface of the proximal surface of the radial carpal bone there. And what we can see in these radiographs is placement of this self-compressing screw. So the good thing about these screws are that they are headless. They're relatively small. They're self-drilling and self-tapping, and you place a guide wire to get your positioning correct, and then drive the screw over the top of that wire. So they are particularly well suited to working in tight areas like articular fractures. And Perry et al. Reported that all fractures demonstrated progression of radiographic healing, and all these dogs were free of lameness at 6 weeks. Two of the five fractures did not complete radiographic union. And that, oh no, one more. So just another unusual presentation of an intraarticular fracture was this sight hound that was presented to us a few years ago when I was at the University of Liverpool, which had this intraarticular fracture of the distal radius that extended into this long oblique spiral fracture of the radius. And that was managed with a buttress plate and lag screws, but I don't have the follow-up images on that particular case. But the dog did clinically well. I think that is pretty much bang on time. That's 1:30 now. So probably just a few minutes to answer any questions that have come in. There's a question been submitted regarding other articular fractures, particularly of the carpus. Essentially, I haven't discussed some of those. This is true. So there are a number of fractures which would be considered articular fractures of the carpus. For example, those of the accessory carpal bone. And I have avoided getting drawn in to discussions on these periarticular fractures, where yes, they are intraarticular, but from a mechanical perspective, they are better off thought about as avulsion fragments of the ligaments and tendons that support the joints. And they have sort of slightly different considerations to your sort of typical intraarticular fracture. There are other intraarticular fractures that we haven't covered here. And I think that is it for questions, Ema.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Ben for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.